Good morning. It is 9:25, Wednesday, April 8th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And Bill, you got some explaining to do about Fawner Park.
Well, as the TDN's Fawner Park reporter correspondent, now I got my title at least, you know, the official correspondent of Fawner Park. Yeah, big happenings yesterday at Little Fawner Park.
Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. Happy Passover to everyone out there that celebrates that holiday. And I'm glad to see that Brian finally shaved. Oh, wait, no, that's Alan.
Hey. I'm Alan Garasso, managing editor of the TDN. Good Pesach to you, John. And I've got Klimt over my right shoulder here. He's by Quality Road, you know. but I'm happy to be on, even if I have a face made for radio and a voice made for a mute button. But glad to be with you guys. Good to see you all.
Yeah, good to see you too, man. Thanks for joining us. Is that the kiss behind you?
That's the kiss.
Wow. All right.
That is the kiss.
Our expert, Al Garasso. All right. So we'll start this week with the obviously the big news is always the coronavirus now in this world. It's a pretty scary time, honestly, especially here in New York. It's probably going to be the deadliest week in New York since 9/11. It's really spreading all over the country. As far as the racing side of it goes, we had another one bite the dust in Golden Gate Fields has now suspended racing. They were still racing up until this past weekend. Seemed like only a matter of time. I think we're down to Oaklawn, Gulfstream, Tampa, and Fawner, which had a little bit of a kerfuffle yesterday with a big pick five carryover and a DQ that was extremely questionable. There were also some news about the Kentucky governor was saying that he's in no rush to get racing back to Kentucky. He's, you know, taking the cautious approach to things. Churchill announced yesterday that they're pushing back the opening of the stabling area even further. It doesn't seem like the Churchill spring meet is realistically going to happen. Same way with Belmont. I think, you know, people are going to be more safe than sorry here in a lot of instances. I got a story coming out later today about the sales. The sales calendar has obviously been hugely interrupted, especially for the two-year-olds. We're going to do, as we do every week now, a lot of speculation. It's unfortunate we have no racing really to talk about this week. At least last week we had the Florida Derby to run down. But just your overall thoughts, guys, on the past week and where we are now.
Well, Joe, first of all, you forgot poor Will Rogers Downs. I mean, right. There's another place out there that is nobody ever heard of until a couple of weeks ago. You know, as you said, it's all speculation, and sometimes it gets a little silly to me. You know, people saying, well, will this track be open on this day, and will this track still be closed on this day? I mean, what's going to happen is racing's going to follow the news. And as long as the news every day is that this thing is getting worse or not getting better, we're going to have a lot of problems. There's some minor little lights at the end of the tunnel. It's been a horrific time in New York, but I know yesterday for the first time, I believe, the number of cases went down. So, you know, does that mean that Belmont's going to start running in 2 weeks? Of course not. But, it, you know, maybe, just maybe, we're starting to see some progress towards an end goal. When is that end goal going to be achieved? And when are we going to start racing throughout the country with or without spectators? We have no idea. I mean, we've talked about the Kentucky Derby being run on September 5th. Really, we don't know that. I mean, we hope that it's going to happen. But the other thing, too, that I don't think a lot of people have paid attention to and I want to put out there is that not only do you only have five tracks running right now, Gulfstream is the only one that keeps going from a meet standpoint. Oakland closes down soon. Tampa Bay closes down soon. Will Rogers closes down soon. And the Immortal Fawner Park also closes down fairly soon. So I don't know what's going to happen to racing in those places, in those jurisdictions, if there's another track that's going to pick it back up. But as I said, it's all speculation and sometimes it gets a little silly. I do think we might be looking at a situation 5 or 6 weeks from now that the only track out there running is Gulfstream.
Not only that, Bill, you're exactly right. And a lot of these tracks that are closing and suspending and halting or also postponing when they're going to open, we touched on last week, is definitely affecting these smaller trainers that only have, you know, a handful of horses to run. One of the things that came out from a business standpoint that I think will help is this P3 loan, which enables any business owner who has less than 500 employees to request, fill out. It's an 8-question questionnaire that you fill out with the bank. And basically, you're eligible to get 2.5 times your monthly payroll. So at least that is, you know, going to be coming through from a financial standpoint. I highly recommend that a lot of the small trainers and small business owners look into it with their local banks, because ultimately the banks are the ones that are controlling those funds. And it does take a couple of weeks for the process, and it takes a couple of weeks to fund. But at least then you'll have an opportunity to continue to run your business for another quarter without having to, at a minimum, without having to reach into your own pocket. I think it's like a 1% annual interest rate, and there's no prepayment penalty. So I would highly recommend that a lot of the small businesses, you know, trainers especially, look into that just so they can keep themselves going.
And I think too, with Churchill's announcement yesterday that the back stretch isn't going to open on time, which was obviously expected. But yeah, I mean, you have a trickle down problem here. People have their horses in places like the fairgrounds. I have a trainer friend at the fairgrounds who's basically in limbo right now, not really knowing what's going to happen and when. I you know, Bill, I hope you would address the economic indicators that you wrote about last week. You know, I mean, it's interesting. We have Will Rogers and Fauner Park in Oklahoma and Nebraska. And I mean, it's fun, at least, that people are betting on these races. I mean, people want to bet. I find it encouraging in a small way that people are still investing in tracks they probably know very little about. And yesterday was Wilma Mankiller Day at Will Rogers. Wilma Mankiller.
Who would have known? Who would have known?
The big one. I think there's another big one as well. But and then too, just looking overseas, just for a second, the English Classics were pushed back. The Guineas and the Oaks and the Derby. So in Royal Ascot, if it happens, it's going to take place in front of an empty grandstand. So obviously, it's impacting all over the world. And, you know, it's a day-by-day, minute-by-minute thing.
I wanted to address something about, like, Dan Ross had a column in yesterday's TDN about the economic impact that this is having on California. Obviously, it's been a really devastating year and a half for California racing at Santa Anita. And it just, this is just kind of piling on. But they made the point, a couple of trainers made the point in the article, that it makes no sense to keep morning training open and not run races during the day, because there's 1,000 people and horses on the track in the morning, and there's probably only 100 or so on the track in the afternoon. So I wonder if you guys have any thoughts on that as to whether or not that's going to be an effective lobbying tactic, because I don't know, it seems at this point, at least, that it's kind of a red state, blue state divide. I think the blue states are being overly cautious now and shutting down things just across the board. And then the red states are going to try to like finagle their way through this epidemic, through this pandemic. Whether or not that's going to be a successful or smart thing, we're going to have to see. I think a lot of these states are a little bit further behind. Bill in Bill's story the other day about Kentucky, he said that the peak, according to the coronavirus, the CDC website, is going to be May 19th in terms of total deaths or highest number of deaths in New York. That's the only kind of good news that we've got right now, is that this week and next week probably are going to be the peak, and then we're going to start to come down. So New York is kind of going first in this way. And it's going to be, it's like we talked about this the last 2 weeks about how it's going to interrupt the racing calendar and the sports calendar, because different states are on different timetables now with this. So it's going to be an ongoing thing, and it's going to be very, very touch and go for a while. But I just want to know what you guys thought about whether or not it makes sense to have horses training in the morning or training in the morning and not racing in the afternoon. Do you think that's somewhere we can make some headway where, you know, it makes more sense just to do the whole operation instead of just a piece of it?
My answers to that are yes and no. Yes, it makes sense, because those of us who understand horse racing understand the argument the Stronach Group, people in California, people actually all over the country are making, that you obviously have to keep training the horses. We need our employees here. They can't go home. Again, it's not like, you know, they're working at a car dealership or something and you're going to shut down and not sell any cars. You go home. The economic engine needs horse racing. We understand that. It needs it in the afternoon. And we can say to the politicians, the people from the health departments, look, you know, this is not anything different than what we're already doing. People are at work. The horses are getting out and exercising. Just let us race them. But we understand that because we're horse racing insiders. But put yourself in the shoes of the governor of X state or the head of the health department of X county. Joe, a word that you like to use a lot on these podcasts, optics. It's really about the optics. And look, people out there don't understand horse racing. And really right now, they couldn't care less about horse racing. People are dying. Nobody out there in the public cares one iota about horse racing other than the people inside the industry. And, you know, from an optic standpoint, it's very hard to explain why you would let horse racing go on. And, you know, it's becoming harder and harder by the day because, as we've seen, the California tracks have been shut down, not by the state, but by county health departments. And I just talked about Gulfstream maybe being the only track running in a month or so. I don't know if Gulfstream's still going to be running. It's just a big guess. So I totally understand where racing is coming from, but I'm actually not surprised that they've shut down so many tracks. I'm surprised that five tracks are still running. I mean, that's actually amazing. And I think the people in horse racing, the Stronach Group and others, have done a very good job of making their case to the politicians, the people that have the ability to shut them down. And yeah, that to me is the surprise. Not that 23 tracks or 25 tracks are closed, that there are still these five racetracks running, and at least hopefully will be running for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, in classes in business school and real life situations where you're trying to negotiate a contract, you're trying to negotiate terms of a deal. And right now, horse racing is negotiating from weakness. There's no, especially in California, there's no way around it. Just with everything that's gone on with the horses, you know, having fatalities and, you know, all the racing woes that we've had in California specifically, which have gotten better, but still the taste that everyone has in their mouth right now is that horse racing in California equals bad. So you have that, you have all the other issues that Bill mentioned just now about people's health, people dying, you know, mortality rates, all those things that are, you know, concerning to the average American, and the average Californian. They could give completely a rat's butt about horse racing right now. So I understand why the trainers and the owners in California are saying, if we're going to do this, then we should be able to do that. But in reality, why would, you know, basically, I think California is going to look at it and say, that's really cute, guys. But ultimately, I don't think that we really care about this in the grand scheme of things. So if you're saying that if you're going to train in the morning, you need to race in the afternoon, then we're just not going to let you train in the morning and close it down and be done with it. So it's just not a great, A, it's not a great optic, to use your term. And B, it's not negotiating from strength. I mean, we're negotiating from weakness on this standpoint of trying to convince people that we should have racing in the afternoon because of the reason we're you know, getting basically the opportunity to train in the morning. I think it's a good thing that we're training in the morning for all the reasons we talked about last week, for the horse's health and for all the people on the backstretch that live there and that, you know, need the money and the paychecks. But I don't think that that's a great argument to be able to say, so that's why we should have racing in the afternoon. You know, if you want to look at it, and I don't know what a good argument would be in this environment right now. You can point to the fact that maybe if you want to make an economic, you know, request and say, look, there was $100 million bet last weekend, $51.5 million at Gulfstream, $21.5 million at Tampa, and $27.5 million at Oaklawn, give or take, not to mention Will Rogers and Fawner. Okay. So it's $100 million. So if California was open, California racetracks were open, we would have X millions of dollars of money floating through, which equals Y dollars of revenue. And therefore those Y dollars could be used to buy masks, respirators, whatever the state needs. That's a better argument than, well, if we're doing this in the morning, then we should do it in the afternoon. I think the tracks are going to, or the state's going to say, well, then we're just stopping doing it in the morning. End of story.
It's amazing. I mean, Gulfstream in particular, because, I mean, reading the tea leaves on Twitter or anywhere else, basically, I mean, the chances of that track operating past Florida Derby Day seemed slim to none. And then when they announced that there was, you know, there was the fourth out of the Rainbow Six, they were going to seed the pool for Sunday. People say, yeah, well, you're not going to race. And then they raced. And then they drew a card for Thursday. And people said, yeah, that's not going to happen either. And, you know, somehow, even within the context of what seemed political action from the mayor of Hallandale, I mean, the fact that they've been able to fight through it, Maybe it's a case that it can be done. It's interesting, not always to bring this to other parts of the world, but so there's a state of emergency now in Japan. The JRA got together overnight and they decided to keep on racing. So, they realize what goes on there and how it fuels, how it's an important part of their lifestyle and economy. Hong Kong is still racing. Australia is still racing. So, I mean, it can be done. I understand all the arguments, John. I mean, your argument is clear. Like, why do it at all? But here's hoping.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope that I'm wrong. I just don't think that's not the argument you want to make. That's not your lead discussion when you're trying to convince the state with all this chaos going on that this is why we need to have racing. It's kind of moving the deck chairs around in the Titanic, quite frankly.
I think the economic argument is a smart one to make. One other thing I wanted to bring up, the sports calendar obviously has been drastically affected by this. We have really no idea whether or not the NBA and NHL seasons, even though I'm the only one who cares about the NHL season, are going to be able to complete. But baseball this week, I wanted to bring this up. Baseball is floating this idea around of starting their season in late May and doing it solely in Arizona, where I guess there is a very small, relatively speaking, number of cases of coronavirus cases. And supposedly they have some kind of, handshake agreement with federal officials. I wonder that if this works out, and I don't think it's going to work out. I think eventually people in the government are going to step in and say, you got to wait. Like, this needs to be a nationwide thing. We have too many players coming in from too many different places. But if this does work out, I wonder if that sets the bar for all the other sports and if racing is then nudged in that direction as well. Because like you guys have talked about, it's easier to do it spectator free for racing because there's no spectators really to begin with at most tracks. The horses are shipping in, but there aren't really people, I don't think, flying in from all across the country. I mean, you have some owners, but I think that racing is in a unique spot that it doesn't have to interrupt operations completely and can still race. I wonder what you guys' thoughts are on the baseball thing, if that's going to work, and if it does work, if that'll set the tone for the rest of the sports landscape.
Well, it would certainly help. I mean, because then racing has something to show to the government. Hey, look at Major League Baseball, which is a much more complex type of thing than we have in horse racing right now. They've been allowed to do this. I'm with you, Joe. I don't think that's going to happen. I even read some reports now where Major League Baseball is saying, hey, people are getting way ahead of themselves on this thing. But if something like that happened, or there was also talk about the NBA finishing up its season solely in Las Vegas. Sort of a similar sort of idea with all the teams get together. There's several arenas, I guess, they have access to. So those sort of things would certainly help horse racing because then it could point to a blueprint of how other sports have done. So I guess in some sort of roundabout way, we should be rooting for baseball and for also because we like these games, not just for how it affects horse racing. But how about this? So if they pull this off in Arizona with the baseball, how about we run the entire Triple Crown at Turf Paradise? That work for anybody?
Kalamazoo Downs. Kalamazoo Downs.
Are we going up four times? Yeah. Is that what we're going to do?
Yeah.
Is
fire not going to be available, Bill?
Well, no, because I'm just taking that Arizona is going to be cleared to have massive sporting events. And one other thing you said, I don't know the complete list, but Oklahoma. So we got already saying Oklahoma, Nebraska, Florida, and Arkansas. And I believe as I speak that Oklahoma, Nebraska, and Arkansas don't have lockdowns in place. They're those, Republican governors that are outliers and no, we're going to keep going on our way. And Florida was very late to the game to cause a lockdown there, very controversial. People were just screaming about how, all these kids were still on the beach and for spring break and that sort of thing. So, Joe, you're definitely right about that. The states that tend to be red states, traditional Republican states, most of them have shut down. But the ones that are still out there allowing people to come and go are all, traditional red states. And I assume all have Republican governors.
So this week on the Writers Room, we're proud to have our first video guest as we branched out into Zoom podcasting. It's the four-time defending Eclipse-winning trainer, Chad Brown. Couldn't think of a better first guest to have. Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With more than 500 clients in the horse business, they were bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. So for this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, we are thrilled to bring on a man who needs no introduction, but I'm going to introduce him anyway. He is the four-time Eclipse defending champion trainer, future Hall of Famer, and our first video guest on the Writer's Room, Chad Brown. Yes.
Thanks for having
us.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So I'll start just with a basic question. Obviously, this situation is affecting us all. Can you just give us a rundown of how it's affecting both your horses and your personal life? I know you got young children. How has the situation been impacting you?
Yeah, so from a business standpoint, first of all, it's been extremely challenging and disappointing. I'd imagine all businesses, small and large throughout the country, is going through the same thing in some capacity. So, we understand we're not alone, but our business really focuses on the teeth of the season from like April 1 to sort of the first week of December is where we make the majority of our prize money and race the majority of our better horses. We participate a little in Florida and it's good racing and all down here, but we just find you can't really race 12 months a year with most of the horses. So we really focus on the time of year where now we're entering a shutdown. So it's been particularly hard for us. A lot of nice horses ready to run, nowhere to go. And then, on the personal front, I have two daughters up in Saratoga and I was supposed to be home by now. And, I hear a lot of stories of like that, from friends of mine, both in and out of horse racing. So I know a lot of families are sort of split apart. Some families are trapped with each other for a long time too. So I guess it goes both ways, but, I'm anxious to try to get home when I can, but right now I have to stay with the majority of my stable, which is in South Florida, and the majority of my employees, which are here. The clients right now, there's so much uncertainty and they need some information. They need it real time. I need to stay here and be sure I'm giving them accurate information.
And Chad, it's Bill Finley here. And at this time of year, you would be getting some of the big stars in your barn, like Uni, Sister Charlie, ready probably for races, I'd imagine, at Keeneland or Belmont Park or something like that. When take those horses or actually, any of your, star horses, when you don't have any specific races out there that you know are going to be available to you, how do you adjust your training for them? Are you, take those horses, are you training them as if they're going to run next month, or are you training them as if they may not run 6 months from now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a very unusual situation to be in. So the answer is I have certain horses that were really ready to run that I've had to pump the brakes on and not breeze them every week anymore. That's the approach I'm taking, just waiting for some information. I don't really want to lose what we gained getting them ready for those first starts that might have been at Keeneland or Aqueduct, really. And then after that, both Belmont and Churchill Derby week. So we sort of had everything lined up and timed right, and most of the horses were hitting their mark. So I have to pump the brakes on those horses and maybe just not breeze them as much, try to put them in a holding pattern, if you will. I have other horses that were a little behind because they needed some extra time off for whatever reason once we did stop on them. Those horses weren't going to begin racing until May or June. So those horses I've sort of kept going with hoping and planning for racing in May and June, knowing it might not happen. And until they're 100% fit and ready to run, I won't pump the brakes on them. Horses like include Sister Charlie that needed extra time. She hasn't even breezed yet. I'm not doing anything different with her. A horse like Cambier Park, she needed extra time. She hasn't breezed yet. Then I have some horses in between that are working that weren't quite ready to run, but they're not that far behind. Horses like Uni and Dunbar Road. So I'm sort of training them. Those two were supposed to run opening weekend of May. I'm sort of just going to keep moving along with them. So I sort of have horses in three groups to answer your question.
And Chad, one of the other times of year, that normally in normal circumstances would be going to these two-year-old sales. And you've had a tremendous amount of luck buying horses at two-year-old sales and having them, through your program. And you've also, you know, when you walk into a sale, you have the clientele that basically, I'm sure, can buy the exact horse that you want. So give us an idea of when you go to those sales, like what are you looking for in an athlete when you're watching a horse either breeze or when you're going to the barns and kicking the tires there?
Yeah, so that's really changed. No, thus far, I haven't been to any sales for the two-year-old sales this year because of all this. And, you know, in general, you know, minus the pandemic right now, our approach at the sales really, you know, I have a team, and particularly at the yearling sales, Mike Ryan's a really close friend of mine and a partner of mine. So he does all of the, you know, field work to really locate horses that he thinks might work for me and some of my clients and some of his clients. And sort of have something to look at from there. Cause as you know, these sales can be overwhelming, especially when I have, you know, a couple hundred horses to train and a couple hundred employees to manage and as many clients, you know, I can't be, you know, full time at the sales and stuff. So that's really worked well for us. And I just try to get to look at a smaller number of horses if I can and sort of pick what I like. But, you know, it's also important to recognize, you know, when you look at our stable from top to bottom, yeah, there's some nice horses that I bought, either that I picked out or I picked out in partnership with someone like Mike or a couple of agents I use. And I have a lot of horses that I had nothing to do with. Either they're homebreds or just sent to me, or horses I passed on at the sales. And someone bought and sent to me, end up being good horses. So the sales are tricky. You know, the longer you do this as a trainer, I find you have so much data built up in your head about what works and what won't work. And the longer I do it, you see more things horses can live with. You know, you see more horses that you passed on for confirmation or pedigree that ended up being good horses. So I find now, when I'm older and wiser, I hope, I have a lot more horses that I have a favorable eye to because I know what they can overcome after seeing so many horses do well that I didn't think early on maybe had the potential.
Right. And is there a specific example of that? Because a couple of trainers that are at your level have said that they've been more understanding as time has gone on.
Yeah. I mean, there's several examples. And then there's some gray area too, like horses in the middle that I didn't hate, but I wouldn't have like stuck my neck out at a big number and ended up being good horses. But I'll give you an example of a horse, Austin Feather. Now, that was earlier on in my career. Like, nobody would buy that horse. I don't care who you are, how smart you are, how many champions you bought if you're an agent or a trainer. Like, that horse was, you know, bought after a two-year-old year, ended up having a bow tendon on the purchase. It was a weird deal, and we ended up getting her back to win in grade one. But I used to watch her train thinking, the horse has no pedigree. She's small. She's not even made well. She walks every day like she's tied up all the time, like she's got muscle cramps. I mean, she's just what... But flat runner, you know, you're not going to find her at a sale. So she'd be an example of that. But there's been lots of them, you know, big, small, crooked, you know, maybe not the favorable pedigree. But, you know, they can overcome a lot. You know, Frankel used to tell me when he's buying a lot of horses privately, I'd say sometimes they'd come in the barn and I'd say, wow, you know, this one has no pedigree. And he told me one day, he says, they make their own pedigree. Now I know what he means by that. You know, they might not have pedigree today. But then after they win a grade one, all their siblings are now have good pedigrees, you know, down the road. So
I have two questions. First, specifically about newspaper of record who you took out of the stakes. We could go Saturday. How's she doing and what are the sort of tentative fluid plans? And then second, just ask you to reflect on your four Eclipse Awards and equaling the record of your mentor, Bobby Frankel.
Well, thanks. So the first question is, a newspaper, a horse is training great. She appears to be nice and settled in her works and, you know, really settled obeying the commands of the rider. And, you know, we contributed to a lot of that last year, I think, you know, trying to get her out to those longer distances where, you know, for three-year-old turf horses in our country, the money's really long. Until you get older, again, four and up, you get back to those mile races. And we had in the back of our mind, she's probably a miler, but we wanted to believe she's so talented she could do it. But, you know, we lost her mentally last year. So we gave her all this time while she's training well. What I had planned to do was run at Gulfstream in that listed race and then come back in the Distaff Turf Mile at Churchill and then come back in the Just a Game and not plan beyond those three races. But with a lot of uncertainty for especially the race at Churchill, I didn't really want to run it for 100,000 on a very firm turf course at Gulfstream that I'm not in love with. I was only doing it as a prep. And when that was taken away from me, the race at Churchill, I just abandoned it. So she's one of the ones I spoke about earlier. It's sort of in a holding pattern. You won't see her work every week right now. But when I see a race schedule that seems pretty firm, then I'll put some horses like her back into full training again. Oh, and then about the Eclipse Awards, you know, it's just been, you know, looking back on it, it's almost hard to believe that it's been four now, when I can remember a day thinking, you know, is our team going to win one, you know, after having a couple good years and coming up short. So, you know, time flies, and we've had a lot of good horses come through and a lot of good clients and, of course, incredible staff. I just feel very lucky to do it. And, but you can't take it for granted. I know how hard it is. Each one of them was, you know, great season from start to finish, you know, right on through the Breeders' Cup. And I feel like having some experience now with the Eclipse Awards, you know, with our sport, the Breeders' Cup really championship weekend, you know, and you need to show up there and be ready. You have to have your horses ready, and your team needs to be ready to perform their best if you want to be in the conversation on Eclipse Award. And thankfully, for all four of those years, you know, on championship weekend, we showed up. And win or lose, the horses, you know, most of them all ran really well. And thankfully, a lot of them did win.
I wanted to ask, one of the themes about this kind of shutdown that's going on right now is that small trainers and small barns are going to have a really tough time bouncing back. And I think that's an overall thing. Small businesses in America are really going to struggle through this period. You had an interesting interview in the TDN last year where you were asked about what can be done to reduce some of the concentration in racing. Obviously, you and some of the other top trainers can weather the storm a little bit better than others. I'm sure you have friends that are small trainers who are struggling. What do you think needs to be done during this time to help those guys kind of see it through?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have any specific ideas other than I think we need to find a way to give some of the smaller businesses some sort of competitive advantage in the marketplace, so maybe they can be priced a little better. You got to give them some sort of angle maybe to recruit some more owners, and then from there they have to be able to show their talent and be able to manage the business. Because this is a very polarizing argument about what I hate the term, the super trainer. You know, I spoke to Bill about it, and it's just not really a fair term. You know, I'm a guy that started with 10 horses. Yeah, I had a great mentor, two great mentors, but they didn't just hand me a bunch of owners and a pile of money and a staff of talented people. I mean, you got to go do it. Now, that said, there's some smaller businesses, some smaller trainers I think have a tremendous amount of talent. And sometimes the doors just don't open for them. So those people, you really have to, we need to try to find an opportunity for them to show what they can do and grow their business, because there's a lot of luck involved too. You know, you have to have the right horses at the right time and things need to go your way. But then on the other hand, you sort of make your own luck, somebody told me. So I'm in favor of not just restricting larger businesses, because I'm not in favor of that. Because the problem is, I have clients, some of them have been in horse racing longer than me. And then when I got them, for whatever reason, some of them, I grew their accounts. Some of them actually told me I was their last stop. This doesn't work, I'm getting out. So they had 5 horses, now they have 20. I have a guy that had 20, now he has 100. So you can't take somebody that's now doing well, making money in the game possibly, winning awards, and reinvesting, buying a lot of horses that trickles down everywhere, and then tell them, you can't use the one person that you've had luck with. You're restricted there. But on the other hand, I think that there's a way where it could possibly be tiered in certain ways to try to help the smaller businesses. Maybe the workman's comp, if you get it all under control, you know, nationally somehow, or even state by state, where it's sort of a co-op, maybe the people that have an X amount of horses and above pay a higher rate, you know, and start, and for your first 20 horses, maybe you don't pay any. You know, some of the places that have stall rent, you know, if you're in Saratoga and the stall rent in the off season, you have to pay stall rent, or you're over here at Palmetto's, or you're maybe, you know, the first 15 horses, you don't pay any, but we sort of tier it up like a tax bracket where the people that have more, I'll pay more. I'll gladly pay more. but I'm not going to give you my owner. I'm not going to hand you money. I'm not going to hand you horses. It's not fair. We earned it, but I'm all for letting them have, create some sort of profit margin for the smaller trainers, lower their expenses. Maybe there's a way to co-op the fee where they pay less. I'm okay. I would never argue about that. You know, until they get up to a certain number of horses, then they hit the next bracket where they have to pay a little bit more. That'd be my idea to do it, that I think is fair to, you know, give people an opportunity to grow your business. But sooner or later, you have to grab the ball and go with it. So that makes sense.
Hey, Chad, one of the things we've been writing a lot and talking a lot about at the TDN is clenbuterol. We had a story earlier this week that Canada has put the restrictions on it, made it much more strict. You can only give it to a horse 28 days out. And when this first came out, I believe you would raise your hand and said, yeah, I don't like this drug either. I don't think it's being used properly. So your thoughts on clenbuterol and perhaps other jurisdictions adopting the rule that Canada did?
Well, like I said on social media, I never used it. Never used it. Now, my horses might have had in the therapeutic situation at the farm if they had an pneumonia or something like that, you know, could have been in the system. But it's my 13th year training horses, and someone responded, well, you know, you're bragging about it only legitimizes the fact. So I've made $180 million in purse money, and never once has one drop of clenbuterol hit one of my horses' mouths. Never. So I'm trying to tell people, fellow trainers, not fans, not media, you don't need it. So look at the results here. You don't need it. So I think it's a terrible drug. I have experience with it actually from Cornell. I went to Cornell. I actually had to write a paper one time on how they use it on beef cattle as a steroid. So I know about the drug, what it does. And they were using it there to bulk up beef cattle or something. I don't remember specifically about the paper I had to write. And I remember about it then. Then I come to horse races and I see it around and I see people using it, but it was never anything I wanted to use. Don't it? So there's a bunch of things we need to clean up, and that's one of them. So I'm happy somebody spoke up, and I was, I was happy to just add something to it that made the argument relevant.
And Chad, one other question for me, you know, we talk about this all the time about, you know, who was our favorite horse, or what was the topic today is what's our favorite race, that we can remember. Obviously, you've won 1,700 races. You've won countless grade ones and all the way down the ranks. It doesn't have to be one of your wins, but was there a win that you remember that just really excited you about the business?
Wow. I'll keep it within the context of me, my business or my life actually participating in horse racing. For me, it's very hard to pick one. But I think Bricks and Mortar, actually the more recent win, there was just so much pressure on that horse. It's sort of like he had the ball. It was his to lose, horse of the year. And it really came down to that one race after everything that happened earlier in the card. And for him to run the table the whole year for a super deserving owner. I mean, that's one of the clients I was talking about when he ended up coming to me. He had horses for, you know, 20 years before he came to me. And he wasn't going to stay in much longer. I can tell you that. I was the last stop. And we were able with Seth to, you know, build this business up, and he's such a, you know, great part of the industry, and he invests so much, and he's a great sportsman. For him to be able to deliver that and the horse show up after a rough trip going farther than he's ever gone, I think for me, and there's so many horses and so many clients to support us, that's probably the race, it's the most recent, but that's something that really, it just reassured me why I do this all the time. You know, we kind of had a up and down year, and through managing so many different parts of the business and some things to overcome. And that was really special. I think outside of that, I think, Empire Maker winning the Belmont with Frankel, I was so relieved for him because I saw how much it meant to him and how much bad luck he had on the Triple Crown. And I couldn't think of anyone more deserving. I admired him so much. Sort of just to see the relief and see a guy kind of like, you know, he was genuinely really, you know, just thrilled over it. And, you know, that comes to mind as well.
John, I want to ask you one question about Tattersalls. You guys have been remarkably successful with the raids on the October sale, Newspaper of Record, Digital Age, Desmarchelier. Whose idea was that in the first place? And what sort of approach you took to that sale different from an approach you take to an American yearling sale?
Yeah, that's a great question. Peter Brandt really, we were going over the yearling sales at Keeneland that year, and he said to me, he goes, you know, the sale's over there, and you have a good eye for turf horses, and, you know, Mike was helping us too. You think Mike will go over? Like, we need to try to go over there and try something different, and then, you know, bring him over here and break them and such. Because even though he buys some horses in Europe and ships them over, some really nice, talented horses, it's, don't be fooled, it's not easy, and it's getting harder. I can remember working for Bobby when they were buying horses in Europe, and it was far easier then to go over there and buy horses. Now, a lot of people don't want to sell them, or the price is very high. You have people, a lot more, a larger percentage of owners I find in Europe now are individuals who don't need to sell or won't sell. It was much different back then. So Peter is a visionary. He saw that. Yeah, we were able to, he was able to buy Sister Charlie or a couple other really good horses. But he says, sooner or later, it's going to get harder and harder to buy these horses. We need to kind of make our own, have our own farm system of European horses. I said, okay. So we built a team out. We sent Mike over earlier. We went over there. I find I have a good feel for turf horses, even if they're yearlings, just by the way they look or the way they walk, or I just have a lot of experience with it. And together we worked and went through the short list, and we were able to pick out some horses. It's, you know, I love having turf horses, and unfortunately we have a good system for it. And it was, we did have a lot of success, particularly that first year. And some of the other horses in the pipeline, just, you'll hear for some more that we bought over there.
I want to ask you one last question before we let you go. We appreciate the time. Last week, kind of just to fill the time, because there's so little news going on, we were talking about our favorite horses, horses that really made impacts on us, and mine was Ghost Zapper. I love Ghost Zapper and his versatility and his brilliance. I just wondered if you had any specific memories about him and kind of what separated him from all the other horses.
Yeah, I worked with that horse a lot. He, that horse was the toughest, biggest hearted horse that I ever worked with. That horse, he was not a real sound horse. And with Frankel, he did not train unsound horses. I trained much the same way. He never injected horses. If they were sore, he stopped on them and waited. And you could say, well, he had great owners. He could, you know, well, yeah, he did, but he wasn't, he earned it. You know, I worked for him later in his career when, you know, the owners, he had them all. They didn't question what he did, which was great. And he just, with that horse, though, that's a horse he normally wouldn't have. That horse wasn't real sound. I mean, that's why he had so many gaps in his races. But he knew with that horse he was safe to go on the track. And we'd look at him all the time, and he wouldn't inject him. He just gave him time. And to see him manage that horse, I'll tell you a funny story about that horse. So I was in Saratoga, and I think it was, I'm trying to think. I can't remember if I was in Saratoga or he was at Belmont, or he was in Saratoga because I was at Belmont. But the horse, the first time the horse was going to go two turns was in the Island. So I was at another division, and Frankel used to call very early in the morning and go over the horses. And he wasn't real chatty, and I should have known better. I always try to catch him to just chat with him, even if it was over a minute at the end about the stable or something. He was very much, okay, ready? We go over the horses. And I asked him at the end, the horse was running that day in the Island, and I thought the horse was just a sprinter or one-turn horse. He was built like a tank, and he was just, he just gave me that feel, that horse. He, looking at him, I mean, I was very inexperienced, but I said, there's no way this horse is going to go long. I didn't see it. So at the end of the call, I said to him, I said, Bobby, you know, good luck today with Ghost Zapper down this one. Do you think that horse can really go two turns? He said, tune in at 5:30. And he hung up on me. What an idiot I am. Why did I even speak up? You know, and sure enough, the horse got probably the highest buyer he got in his whole career that day. But he just knew, you know, he knew about that horse. And to think the horse went all the way a mile and a quarter was amazing. You know, he was, he was my second favorite horse. My favorite horse was Medaglia d'Oro. He was my favorite horse.
Yeah. But, that makes sense. Makes sense.
So Chad, just one more quick one. Was it tougher to get through Cornell or like a training apprenticeship with Frankel, or like, you know, sitting with Dr. Alday and doing rounds with him? Those are, I mean, those are all pretty salty rites of passage for you.
I learned everything I know from Frankel.
Yeah.
And I had to move out to Hollywood, and he taught me everything, and he knows the right way to take care of horses.
Yeah, I can't thank you enough for the time, man. Thank you so much, and stay safe, you and your family, and all your help. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As the Green Group Guest of the Week, Chad Brown will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. The Green Group, bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, bred to save you money.
And so Bill had something interesting in his Week in Review on Sunday about virtual racing and how certain ADWs are starting to take it. It's actually started overseas in Europe. It's kind of caught on. Almost everything is shut down there. And it's just starting to make inroads here in the U.S. Tampa Bay Downs, I think, is the only track right now that's having these virtual races. Reminds me of Gallup Racer. I don't know if any of you guys used to play Gallup Racer on PlayStation. You're all too old. I used to play Gallup Racer on PlayStation, but I wasn't able to bet on it.
Is that where you could like breed the horse and you could actually, yeah. Okay. And you get progressively better.
Right. And you get to virtually ride the horse too. Yep.
You're still too old, John. Don't worry about it.
I remember the most exciting thing for me was the actual naming of the horse part.
Right.
That was like the really cool thing. So
it's still the most exciting part for you.
It still really is. And that's why I was so disappointed. We're going to harken back to the Fonner Park thing. But, you know, I was so disappointed with some of the names that we had put in for the past, like Where's Rufus and Chili Willy. And they were already taken by horses that were running at Fonner.
But yeah, I'll hand it off to Bill here because he brought this up in his story. Bill, what do you think about this? And do you think it has any standing power in America?
Well, a little background first. And it started over in England. And basically, these are computerized races. The difference between the model in England and the model in the US is that the model in England are just made up races with an algorithm that so and so wins. These are actually based on real races that took place in the past. So you could be betting the first virtual race from Tampa Bay Downs, and it might be a race that was run in, you know, 2004 or something like that. They change all the names of the horses, et cetera, so nobody can look up old charts and, you know, make a virtual racing betting coup, so to speak. On the surface, I mean, it's not a very good product. The takeout is 22%. You have virtually no past performances whatsoever. And, you know, it'd be like betting Keno or something like that. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see how this progresses because, you know, will people quote unquote bet on anything? We're going to find out in the future because now only three ADWs have this. But I bet you, especially if we lose more tracks, you know, you get the big boys like Twin Spires and ExpressBet and TVG, et cetera, to start taking this kind of betting. You know, will there be an appetite for it? Well, did anybody think they would bet $7.2 million on the card on a Tuesday at Fonner Park? Now, Fonner Park real racing is light years better than virtual racing, but what we're seeing there is that people do have an appetite to bet on something. And if virtual racing is all that's out there, yeah, I bet you the people will be betting on it. Why not?
I was going to say, once you start betting on Fonner and Will Rogers Downs, it's not that much of a step further to bet on these made up races, but it's kind of like the historical racing, isn't it? And we always make fun of people for betting that.
Yes and no. And you know, historical racing is really what they said. That's a casino product. You know, you put your money in, you press a button, something happens and you lose. You know, you lose your money. It's as simple as that. And it takes about 2 seconds, right? I believe I've only seen virtual historic racing one time. I saw it at Oakland and didn't pay much attention to it. So, you know, they say this is a simulcasting product. So on 3 weeks from now when Fonner Park is closed on a Tuesday, will there be simulcasting of fake races from Tampa Bay Downs? So that's what separates it from the historical racing standpoint. Also, the race, if it's a 6-furlong race, it will take a minute and 12 seconds for the race to play out in real time. So that's what makes it much different than the historical racing type thing. You know, it's not my cup of tea. I don't think I've gotten so low yet that I'll be betting on it. But, you know, will other people be betting on it? It'll be very interesting to see how that works out.
Yeah, you know, you wonder about some of these circumstances, and you know, we kind of scoff at certain things in the horse industry and in the world. But, you know, after going through the Netflix queue and seeing there wasn't anything else to watch, I ended up watching the Cornhole Championships on ESPN. Now, I didn't bet on them yet, but that's like the sports, you know, junkie in me needed some kind of action, and that was on ESPN. So ESPN, the Ocho, is the new ESPN, basically, because there's just nothing out there. So if you say to me, John, if people are addicted to gambling or really want to gamble and there's nothing else to do, are they going to gamble? What are they going to gamble on? Well, that's where you start getting these esoteric kind of, you know, options like virtual, you know, racing and simulcasting, and you can bet on it. I just wonder if one of my horses is represented, am I going to get any kind of a fee for that? Am I getting any kind, even though they changed the names and changed the colors, it was still my property.
This is how you afford the Rolls Royces, is extracting every single possible dime from it.
You got to make money. None of these racetracks are open right now where we have a chance to make any purse money. So, it's no different than licensing. I'm just thinking of this, but it's no different than NCAA basketball players who have their likenesses on, you know, video games. And technically, they change the names and change the uniforms, but it's still the same colleges and still the same numbers on their jersey. I mean, you can tell who, you know, who is represented in there. So they are starting to get paid on that. So do the owners and trainers and jockeys start getting paid on some of these things as well?
Well, I have an answer to that. And again, first of all, right now they're probably handling $50 a race or something like that. So it doesn't make any difference. But if this ever did take off, and again, that's what makes it different from the thing in England, is that the ADWs will pay Tampa Bay Downs or whatever track they say Hawthorne is coming on next. They'll pay the same sort of fee they pay for a simulcasting signal. So I would guess Tampa Bay Downs probably gets about 4-5% for most ADWs, or maybe even less for its signal. So if a certain ADW handles $1 million on Tampa Bay virtual racing, they would pay, what would that be, $40,000 or so into the purse account. And again, I'm sure they don't pay anything in England. So, you know, again, we're talking about something right now. We're getting way ahead of ourselves. But if it ever did get to the point where, you know, they were handling $7.2 million on fake Fawner Park rather than real Fawner Park, yeah, and that money would go back to racing.
Would it be called Fawner Park at that point? All right.
I'm rubbing off on you, John.
I love having you here, Al.
We're like kitty corner here.
I want to make 2 points on that real quick. One, about the England thing, we should mention that they had a virtual Grand National, and the profits or the proceeds from it were donated to the NHS. So that was kind of a way to get people to rally around it. And it seemed like, you know, people got into it a little bit specifically because of that charitable aspect of it. Second thing is, I've been watching on ESPN, not the Ocho, the actual ESPN, and they've been doing an NBA 2K tournament with real players like Kevin Durant and like these guys playing against each other.
Right.
I found myself watching it for like a half hour. Like I turned it on. I was like, are they really doing this? And then
There's nothing else to watch at this point.
It's something.
I know. It's when I saw that on the description for the show, I was like, Kevin Durant, he's rehabbing. What do you mean he's playing? And because that was like the tease was Kevin Durant versus, you know, Stanley Doofendecker in the bubble, and Durant lost.
He got killed.
Yep.
I say, like 30 feet from where I'm sitting, about every day, in between like science and quadrilaterals, my 10-year-old has Jake J, he plays for the 76ers. He's 81-1 in his own personal little 2K tournament.
Wow.
So I've been exposed. Hey, listen to you all watching ESPN, Ocho, whichever ESPN. All I'm watching is Study Island and fifth grade math. God bless y'all.
Well, it's about time you graduated.
I know. I found that my skills are okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, God, I don't have kids at this very moment.
There's a lot of us in that camp.
Yeah, man. God bless you, Al.
I'll survive. Look at me.
At least your kids aren't like really little, right?
Right, 10, 13, and 14.
All right. All right, but so they're demanding, at least somewhat.
Demanding. They're demanding. Yeah.
Okay. But I feel like we have really little kids who need like constant attention. That's where people call it crazy.
Yeah, that'd be hard.
This week's news is sponsored by West Point Thoroughbreds. Owning a multiple grade stakes winning racehorse, grade one winner, like Hard Not to Love is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Check out why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit our website, westpointtb.com. So West Point was actually pretty active at the OBS March two-year-old sale, the last two-year-old sale, probably for a little while. They wound up with two colts and two fillies, and they figured to have a few more to offer by the time the sales calendar restarts. All the info is always available at westpointtb.com. It's a mixed emotions on Saturday when Winning Impression got DQ'd and placed fifth for interference after finishing first by a length and a three-year-old allowance. But in the long run, lots to look forward to for him with him for trainer Dallas Stewart. Definitely the right year to have a later developing three-year-old. They have Chestertown as well. So we wish West Point all the best, obviously, and glad they were able to get in a couple purchases under the wire at OBS March. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. So Bill had a story recently with Mark Cassie about about Canada restricting clenbuterol use. Now you can't administer it within 28 days of a race. It used to be 7 or 14. This kind of ties in a little bit into the recent doping scandal and the arraignments which happened last week. Bill, what was your sense from Cassie about how much of a difference this is actually going to make and whether or not other jurisdictions are going to pick this up?
Well, I think it will make a big difference. Now, first of all, Mark said, well, he's happy to see the rules changed in Canada to go from 7 to 28 days. He's still calling for a complete 100% ban of the drug. You just can't use it, period. So, you know, is that where this is all going down the line? Perhaps, you know, we don't really, you know, it's all speculation. You know, are guys on the backstretch using this drug as a performance enhancer? Yeah, they probably are. Mark says that they are. And he also did admit that it's, if you can only put it out 28 days, it's going to be a lot harder to get a performance enhancing effect out of it, which he said has been very much similar to steroids. So, you know, this is kind of a no-brainer, you know, from what everybody says, that this is a drug that is being misused and not being used for the kind of purposes that it was originally designed for as the bronchodilator. Yes, absolutely. It sounds like they should be getting rid of this drug. Hopefully this will sweep across all of North America, and it'll start with 28 days, and maybe next year we'll talk about it being done with altogether. It'll be interesting to see if they get racing going again in Canada, if this affects some trainers. You know, will these guys who are maybe 26, 27% trainers and perhaps using clenbuterol to get those kind of results, will they have more, you know, realistic kind of numbers? That's what I want to see.
I should mention also, we talked to Chad Brown and he kind of echoed what Mark Cassie was saying about how it's a really, you know, it's a terrible drug and that it doesn't need to be used in horses. And he had a lot of other interesting thoughts as well. Anything from John or Al?
I'm really pleased that a major racing jurisdiction is going this route. The fact that it's 28 days is still probably not long enough, and I think that's what Mark was basically saying in the interview. And I would love to see it not only go through North America to the racetracks, like Bill said, but I know I'm kind of, you know, banging this drum, but I would love to see the 2-year-old and training sales companies put this in. If not 28 days, then, you know, just a permanent ban altogether on it. Because quite frankly, that's still the Wild West as far as, as far as drug use and, lack of oversight.
Hey, John, I believe it is banned in 2-year-old sales. I'm not 100% certain, but I think that it is banned in 2-year-old sales. At least that's what Mark said. So he's talking about weanlings and yearlings and what effect that may have on them at the sales.
Right. Yeah. And I'm really pleased to see that this was the year that the 2-year-old sales are actually even addressing it. Because in the past it was like, it was like, oh, well, that's cute that you think that we shouldn't have horses, you know, taking medication, but then, your alternative is not to buy. And they basically were, basically playing chicken with the owners or the end users as far as who was going to buy horses that were drugged, and if they actually were going to pull blood after they either in the pre-purchase or in the post-purchase, vetting out process. So I'm pleased that they're going that direction. Hopefully it'll be 2-year-olds, then it'll be the yearling sales. And God, why they would even be using clenbuterol on young horses like weanlings just is sickens me, quite frankly. I mean, I know you can say, well, there's, you know, if a horse has pneumonia or has, an issue with breathing, then we need to do it. There are other drugs that can just as easily do it that are non-steroidal, or synthetic even, that can be used to clean up a horse's lungs. So it really turns my stomach when they talk about, you know, young foals, like they were literally just weaned 6 to 8 months old, and they're already on an steroid. It's just not the right thing to do.
I don't really have much to add other than when Bill did the story with Mark Assey up front a few weeks ago, I know Jim Lawson replied on Twitter that that Mark's voice was going to be heard. And in this world of kind of do as I say, not as I do, it's good to see a guy like Jim Lawson, who's been at the forefront. I mean, he's always been proactive and seems to get things done. So it's good to see him put his money where his mouth is.
I think also the point about weakening the breed that we've talked about in the past, and I think that's especially cogent when it comes to treating horses that early. When you're getting drugs in their bloodstream that early on, that's the kind of thing that I think is irreversible and adds up over time with horses. Not a horse anatomy expert, obviously, but it would just seem logical that if we're treating these horses that early on, we're kind of masking weaknesses, and then that gets perpetuated in the breed. TDN Riders Room is brought to you by Keeneland, home of world-class racing and industry-leading sales. Entries for the 2020 September yearling sale are open through Friday, May 1st at september.keeneland.com. Before we sign off today, I wanted to give it up to our managing editor, Alan Carasso, who had some words about just the effort that the TDN staff is putting in across the world as we deal with these unprecedented times.
I just wanted to say how proud I am to be part of this collective in these tough times where there's just almost nothing happening at the racetrack. You know, for us to be turning out the content that we are, I really think we're playing a role in everyday lives of people, giving them a distraction from coronavirus and giving them something interesting to read. Bill's efforts have been Herculean. Sue right at the top as the orchestrator. Dan Ross, Jessica Martini has been amazing, just a machine with what she's churned out. Across the pond, Emma Barry, Dahi Harvey, all the Team Euro, and giving us coverage of the situation from Europe, and tip of the cap to everyone involved, advertising, photo editors. It's just been amazing what we've done. So just a pat on the back to everyone.
And we appreciate all the words, Al. I second that. I think everyone is doing yeoman's work now and really working hard. And we also appreciate all the kind words from everyone coming in, from all the readers and the viewers and the listeners telling us how much they really enjoying the content and how it's kind of helping them get through a tough time. So second everything you said, Al, and we're gonna keep doing our best to keep putting out great content for all of you. With that said, the TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland, home of world-class racing and industry-leading sales. Entries for the 2020 September yearling sale are open through Friday, May 1st at september.keeneland.com. So that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room. Really great work by everybody. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Alan Carasso, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Chad Brown, as well as our producer, Patty Wolf, and our editors, Nathan Wilkinson and Anthony LaRocca. We will see you next week.